Our guest tonight is feminist, economist, and environmentalist Gwendolyn Hall-Smith. There will be time for Q&A following Gwen's presentation. Gwen consults with cities and communities on creating sustainable policies for energy, investment, and food systems. Gwen lives in Cabot, Vermont, writes extensively about the economy, and envisions a new kind of caring economy that works for everyone, grows her own food, and helps run an eco-village. Welcome, Gwen, and please give us more information about the kinds of organizing we can connect with around the country for the climate strike.
Great, thank you. So nice to be here. Thank you for inviting me. And I just love to have a discussion afterwards, so I'm not going to make a long presentation, but I will tell you a little bit about what I know. This climate strike is really being led by children. That's an important fact that I think should at least alarm all of us to get involved. Because if you're like me, you think that people who are less than, let's say, 18 years old really ought to be spending their time being children, not being so worried about their future that they're striking from school and otherwise organizing. It's a lot of work, the whole world, to support their right to a future. Greta Thunberg, who has recently arrived in the United States from Sweden, is one of the key leaders of this movement. A couple weeks ago, I organized a flotilla in New York City to greet her and welcome her when she came to the United States. She sailed on a racing sailboat that was owned by the grandson of Grace Kelly and Prince Rainier of Monaco. It's called the Malizia 2. And right now, actually, it's on its way back to Europe or to England, but en route, it hit either a container or a sleeping whale, unfortunately. So they're both the boat is now docked in St. Pierre off of Newfoundland and getting repaired, and the crew is recovering. It was a little bit like being in a collision. But fortunately, that didn't happen while it was bringing Greta over here. They dodged a couple major storms and made it safely into New York Harbor around August 28th, I think. We were there with a flotilla from the United Nations who had sails made for 17 sailboats depicting the Sustainable Development Goals. It was really a wonderful day, and I was happy to have helped organize it. Greta is a force of nature. She's 16 years old and has been diagnosed with Asperger's, which she describes as a superpower. It makes her quite attentive to all the things that she's needed to learn to say things about the climate that are highly technical and difficult to understand, and she does an excellent job. If you're curious about that, you can watch an interview she did with Amy Goodman of Democracy Now! The other day, or the interview she did with Trevor Noah of The Daily Show last night, or an interview she did several days ago with Naomi Klein. She's really been busy. She does well on her feet. She's asked incredibly difficult questions, everything from technical terms about what the climate is doing to the hate mail and correspondence she's been receiving to what it means to be diagnosed with Asperger's and be on the public stage and how she copes with that. And I really admire her deeply after watching her in action for several weeks now. I'd encourage you to do the same. But this movement that she has sparked, the climate strike movement, is truly global in its scope. I've had up close and personal experience with this recently because I started to get the flotilla organized. I started this Facebook group called hashtag YouGoGreta. My intent in starting the group really was just to corral some of the people that I knew might be interested in the flotilla and coordinate our efforts, but it has grown exponentially since I started it. As of tomorrow, we will have 2,000 members. I can predict that pretty confidently because it's just every time I get back to the computer, there's 8 or 10 or 20 or 40 more members that want to join. And the membership is from all over the world. I look at the list of countries of people who are supporting Greta, and there was 95 the last time I counted. There are people from all walks of life. There are people from all levels of education, everything from fairly young children to boomers like me. And it's so inspiring. I've had some dialogues with some of the people that have joined, and Greta has literally changed their lives. They've gone from being someone who was sitting on their hands and not doing anything about their own lifestyle or what they could do about the climate crisis to real activists that are getting out there and talking to their grocery stores about single-use plastic, wrapping all the vegetables and taking the bus to work instead of driving their car, and all the things that, anyway, those of us who've been very interested in climate change for a long time have been doing for a long time. So that has been really encouraging and inspiring, that somebody like Greta could have sparked a truly global movement. The Fridays for the Future map, if you go on the web and look it up, shows where the students have been striking all over the world. It blankets Africa, Asia, North and South America, Europe. There's just hundreds and hundreds of them. And all of the little dots on the map are children that have walked out of school on Fridays and sat in front of the decision-making palaces, parliaments, congresses, town offices, whatever they can find nearby, and held up signs about paying attention to the climate. Tomorrow, Greta Thunberg will be in front of the White House. I've been organizing a little bit about that because I know some people in Washington, and my dream was to get 1 million people there tomorrow to support her and have the people stay until he who shall not be named resigns. That's a good dream. Maybe it will happen. I think the idea of surrounding the White House and just not going away until we get better representation isn't a bad one. And I know, of course, that all of you have been working on similar things for a long time. I'm a longstanding admirer of Wilt. So I can tell you a little bit more about personally what I'm doing in my little town, and that has been working with the high school students here who are interested in Greta Thunberg and the climate strikes to help them understand the science and understand what to do to organize around that. That's something you can do in your own town between now and next Friday. If you know some high school students, talk to them, find out what they're doing. If you know people that have the ability to go on strike on Friday, talk to them. Try to get them to go out on strike and do like Greta, go to a place where decision makers convene. She's been sitting outside of the Swedish parliament for the last year every Friday, and hold a sign saying it's time to do something about climate change. It's time to unite behind the science. So I'm working in Cabot. I convened a group of singers yesterday, kind of like the Raging Grannies, and we compiled a full concert of fossil fuel songs, which has been kind of fun. A friend of mine rewrites classical tunes, and she had some really good ones. One was "Bye Bye Fossil Fuels," da 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 da. So if any of you are singers and like to do that, I can send you the SoundCloud links because you can learn them and sing them on your own. We're going to be participating in a bunch of activities around here in Vermont, including a bee dye-in that will be happening in Burlington one of the days, where everybody will be dressed as bees and will fall over and do a flash mob kind of thing. Up in Montreal on the 27th, Greta will be there. She'll be in New York City on the 20th. But literally, you can go to this website, Fridays for the Future, which is organized by all these high school students, and look to see where near you there's a weekly strike occurring and join in. You don't need to be in any major cities or major areas because literally, they're all over the place. And if there isn't one near you, organize one and put it on their map. That would be really helpful. And then other people may go to that map and join you. Organize a meetup. Organize a Facebook group in your town. There's lots to be done, and it doesn't take a lot of sophistication or planning in particular, partially because there's such a broad movement already. The other movement I've been supporting for the last year or so that you may know about already is the Sunrise Movement, another movement led by young people. The Sunrise Movement tends to be college students rather than high school students, but they've been pushing for the Green New Deal and trying to get the Green New Deal on the legislative agenda in Congress and in the state level. I wrote a paper just this week for a group of economists that have been working on something they call the economics of the Anthropocene. There'll be a conference on that up in Montreal next month. And I think Mary Beth circulated it to all of you. It's just a short paper on how we pay for the Green New Deal. Bernie Sanders just released a $16 trillion program for that. And that's a staggering amount of money. It's 16 times our annual defense budget. If it was all in 1 year, it would represent 80% of our GDP. How do we pay for that? And one of my passions, in addition to climate change and environmental integrity, has been economic reform, because I've been an environmentalist ever since I was Greta's age. It wasn't climate change I discovered back then, it was nuclear power. So I was on a slightly different track, but ironically, the same strategies that we were using to fight nuclear power plants back then are the strategies we need to fight climate change, because it was the growth in energy consumption that was driving the construction of new nuclear plants. And so cutting back energy consumption was one of the best ways to stop them from being built. And that led me all sorts of places. I've done environmental work now for 45 years. And one of the things that I'm convinced of in my old age, I'm not that old, I turn 60 next week, but is that the economy and the economic structures, the man-made economic structures, are the real problem. If we change those structures, we can change everything. The structures are what are driving the growth imperative. It's what's driving species extinction, resource depletion, climate change, and human impoverishment. The structures I summarize in another paper I wrote, you can count them on one hand, and I talk about the mantra for the new economy being OM, because the acronym for the structures is OMMMM, and it stands for ownership, money, markets, management, and metrics. Those are the key economic structures that drive the system that we use and that is raping and pillaging the earth and impoverishing
humanity.
Could
you say that one more time, Gwen?
Sure. It's ownership, money, markets, management, and metrics. And I do have a short article that I wrote for Moon Magazine that you can find on the web. You could Google Gwendolyn Hall Smith, OMMMM, and find the article that goes into more detail about all the different ways in which those structures need to change. And I'm also writing a new book about it now. So that'll be coming out once I get it written. I have to confess that over the summer I haven't done such a good job of keeping on track, but I'm going to get back on track next week, she says confidently. But I've been interested in monetary reform for a long time too. And really, when you get right down to it, the reason ownership comes before money in the mantra is because who owns the money is a big part of the problem. We tend to think we have a public money system, but we don't. We have a privatized money system. So I love the fact that Wilf is going to be focusing on public banks. That is a critical strategy for changing it. It's not everything, but it would take some really big steps in the right direction if we could implement the type of network of public banks at the national, regional, and local level that the Green New Deal legislation envisions. And I talk a little bit about it in the essay that Mary Beth handed around. That's really a lot of what I had to say. I can go on and on, but I'd love to have a conversation instead of just sitting here talking to the sunset out my window. So does people have questions? Do they have comments?
We're going to take a stack. If you have questions or comments for Gwen, please raise your hand by pressing number 1 on your phone keypad right now. I'll start while we wait for people to press number 1. Gwen, how did you come to organize the Welcome Flotilla? How did you fall into that?
Isn't that funny? I know. Here I am, a landlubber, way up in landlocked Vermont, going down to New York and getting on a sailboat. Well, it's interesting because I've been working with the high school students here in town, and I organized a big event for them in the legislature when the climate strikers were doing another big action back in March. And I asked them, who would you like to meet? What would you like to do? Who could I arrange to maybe come and speak? So that, and one of them said, I'd really love to meet Greta Thunberg. And I thought, oh, wow, that's a tall order.
Yeah.
But it was literally the next day that she was leaving on the sailboat from the UK to come to the United States. So I said, well, one way we might be able to meet her is if we organize some kind of welcome for her when she gets here. I have a kayak or two, and I could go down and paddle out. So I started organizing this You Go Greta group and the flotilla, largely because the kids here in Cabot really wanted to meet her. Now, I used to be a sailor. I worked on the Greenpeace ship back when I was younger, the Rainbow Warrior, and I'm still in touch with some of the people there. And, I've done work with the Hudson River Sloop, the Clearwater, before, so I got in touch with them. I got in touch with the RW. I looked up a lot of the boating groups around New York City. I set up the Facebook group, and started organizing. And it was really magical the way it all came together. I was so impressed with the flotilla that managed to get deployed. Now, I have to assume that the UN was planning that more in advance than just me organizing it, but I really don't know, because I was meeting a lot of resistance to doing anything at all. I think it was partly because the high school kids really wanted her to themselves, God bless them, and they were saying, oh no, Greta doesn't want a big welcome. So people were saying, no, we're just not organizing anything. And I said, wait one minute, she's traveling on this high profile racing sailboat with a filmmaker from England to do a massive publicity tour here on climate change. I just don't believe that. I'm sorry, but I just don't believe. So I just kept doing it. And, it all came together in the end, which was wonderful. And I wasn't trying, people were being really careful about her Asperger's, I guess. She's not socially very comfortable, but I never had, at least with the flotilla, I wasn't particularly interested in meeting her in person that day. I was doing it to try and help welcome her here, and with the hopes that I might eventually meet her or, bring her to Vermont. I haven't been successful with that yet, but I was successful at getting in touch with the people who are in charge of her schedule, and I just keep getting a no from them. But she's going up to Montreal, and Montreal is relatively close to here compared to New York City or other places she's going to be. And so me and my friend Dakota, she's one of the songwriters, and she has one of these electric cars, are going to go up there and participate in the climate strike on the 27th in Montreal.
Very neat. I'd see. We have a lot of questions for you now, so I'm going.
Oh, great.
I'm going to start asking. Ann Henney has her hand up. Ann is a Wolf member from East Bay, California, but she's also really active with the Sierra Club. Ann, go ahead.
Yeah. Hi, Gwen. Wonderful talk. I think many people are inspired by Greta's her commitment to not flying. And as an activist, for example, I know that I have an opportunity to go to Santiago, Chile, and participate in some of the actions and even the negotiations for the COP meetings in December. And I feel very torn about that. And my husband and I have both refrained from traveling by plane for the most part. And it's not just because of Greta, but it's because we know what's going on. And we know that we all have to stop taking a lot of the consumption and waste for granted that have gotten us to this point collectively. So I just wonder if you could comment on that dilemma.
Yeah, I hear you. For my part, for many years, I was doing international environmental work. I worked for the UN in Japan and UNEP, the International Environmental Technology Center there, and I worked with the US EPA to do projects in Central and Eastern Europe when the wall came down. I've done projects in Africa and Serbia and Costa Rica. And so my carbon footprint from environmental work is shocking. I've been around the world 3 times. I've probably traveled 1 million miles in planes. I did make a concerted effort, though, over the last several years to just stop doing that. And when people want me to come and talk, I tell them I'm really adept at using Zoom and happy to do it that way. Unless I need to be there in person for some reason, like I'm facilitating a process or something like that. But I completely relate to your dilemma because it's a really tough one. I know that some of my mentors, you know, when I would raise this with them, like, gosh, you know, we have to fly a lot to do this work. Shouldn't we think about that? They're saying, you know, Gwen, you're flying to try and change the system. You're working hard to change the system. The vast majority of people in the air are not doing that. They're the corporate folks that fly because of the horizontally integrated corporation out there. They're vacationers and travelers for not the same purpose. And you know, be sure to get the carbon offsets for it if you can, but you shouldn't agonize over it so much. And so for a long time that helped me get through it, but I agree with you. I think Greta's on the right track. And I think we really do need to work harder on figuring out ways to come to global meetings and be at global meetings and have these conversations on a global basis without actually investing in all that carbon to get places. The other thing, from my point of view, having worked with the UN, is that unfortunately, a lot of these big UN meetings, you know, if you were a Martian, I remember I helped with the big world water thing that happened in Japan back when I was working there. And you know, when I really watched what was going on and imagined somebody from outer space landing and seeing this huge meeting with all these parties and people flying in from all over the world and understanding really what did and didn't get done at those meetings, you know, the Martian would sit there and scratch their heads and say, you know, you guys have a real water crisis on this planet. And what I see happening is you're throwing these big expensive parties where the corporations get there and try to convince everybody in government to privatize the water system. And the money that costs, oh my God, the costs of these meetings are staggering. You could be spending the money actually fixing the problem and making a lot more progress than doing these big international hoo-has, you know. So, you know, that's another point, is think about what it is you're doing to travel. You know, does you're going to one of the COPs accomplish anything really? And how much are you going to spend on it? And could you make a donation to a project that's well run in some country to accomplish the same thing? You know, maybe if we rerouted some of the funding away from these global hoo-has and into the work, it might work better.
Okay, we have a question from Robin in Mendocino County. Robin, your mic is open.
Hi. I don't exactly have a question. I've got some comments. First, I want to say thank you, Gwen, for all you do.
Well, thank you.
Oh, I just, someone mentioned public is one of the aims or something, and just 2 days ago I gave a presentation on public banking to the American Legion Post. They
wow.
invited me, and so I gave a presentation, so even the American Legion is thinking about public banking. Also, I'm a member of the Climate Action, the Mendocino Climate Action. And so I invited Greta Thunberg to come to Ukiah to speak. And unbelievable, my fellow members of the committee told me, oh, don't be doing that. She's so busy. She can't see us. And you said something. You got so many obstacles trying to arrange this flotilla that you did. And, yeah, you know, just something simple is reaching out, and all these fellow people just saying, oh, you can't do that. Oh, no, you can't do that. And then my last comment is that for over four decades, I've been a volunteer with the Red Cross. And I'm the Red Cross nurse for Mendocino County. And I've been trying to convince them that using fossil fuel vehicles is counterintuitive to their mission of alleviating suffering. And so getting the Red Cross to change, I've done it twice before now, and this is now my third effort to get them to change their national policies. But this takes, it's a giant wheel that you have to roll uphill, and so it takes a lot of repetitive efforts to get them to change. But I think they're starting to listen to me.
Well, and thank you for your work. They need to hear from many of us about that from different parts of the country. Maybe that would have more impact. We have a question from Lorna Paisley in Los Angeles, California. Go ahead, Lorna.
I just wondered if you could clarify something, because there's opposite points of view, and it's about how much oxygen does the Amazon make for people to breathe? I heard it's basically none, that the trees use most of it up. Most people think it's 20%. What's the fact? Thanks. That's it.
Oh, gosh. I actually don't know the percentage, but I do know that that's one of they're the lungs of the planet. The trees in the Amazon produce a lot of oxygen. I think one of our real concerns with watching it burn is that that's a critical feedback loop for life on Earth. So I would not support the people that say that the trees themselves use them all up. The trees actually eat carbon dioxide and emit oxygen.
Right.
That's the opposite.
Yeah, I know they.
Use, so.
I know they use
I can
a lot
Google
of carbon
it while we're on the phone.
Okay.
Okay, and I have a question from Ellen Thomas. Ellen is one of the co-chairs of our Disarm Committee. She's in Tryon, North Carolina. Go ahead, Ellen.
Thank you, Mary Beth. Yeah, this is very interesting, and I was quite thrilled when I heard that you were meeting with Greta. And I have a question, because I suggested that Wilf ought to propose Greta for the Nobel Peace Prize, because I think she's definitely earning it, but or at least some Nobel Prize. But I heard that she believes that nuclear is part of the solution, and our focus in the Disarm and Wars Committee is to end the whole nuclear era, because, of course, as long as there are nuclear power plants, there can be nuclear weapons, and also there's the waste, and it's a hell of a way to boil water, which you know because you're an anti-nuclear person yourself. And I just wonder if anybody has talked to her and taught her more about nuclear, the dangers of nuclear, the long-term and the current dangers of nuclear, so that she can stop if she is, in fact, saying that nuclear is the solution.
I have not heard her say that. Now, I'm looking quickly at, you know, the Google brain, and I see that personally I'm against nuclear power. It's something she said. I haven't heard her say anything about nuclear power. I would think if she really has studied the data, she would know that in order for a nuclear power plant to be considered even remotely carbon neutral, it has to run close to 20 years without a flaw because of its carbon debt. Especially the light water reactors that are made in the United States, the concrete and the enrichment and the mining that go into creating the fuel is staggeringly energy intensive and relies a lot on the coal burning plants in the Midwest to do it. So you've got a lot of coal electricity embedded in every nuclear power plant, to say nothing of the concrete. Concrete is a nightmare when it comes to climate impacts. So anyway, I don't know where that is. I think that the IPCC report does say it can be a small part of the energy future, but I just am not aware of a lot of people that, here's a post she wrote. Oh, gosh, it's really long. So I'm not going
to
read it.
Okay. We're going to move on to another question.
Yeah. I hope she isn't. Somebody needs to educate her.
If you get an opportunity to ask her.
I will.
Yeah. Thanks, Ellen. Mary Bricker Jenkins from Tennessee. Go ahead. Your mic is open.
Hi, and thank you so much for this presentation. It was wonderful. I have three quick things. One is that I'm sure you're familiar with a quote from Margaret Mead, "Never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has." And you and those people around you and Greta certainly constitute that small group of thoughtful, committed citizens. And I'm just so thrilled that you're doing what you're doing and those around you are doing what you're doing. You know, at the same time, what makes the difference is not just the spark, it's also the fuel that is ready to be ignited. So I'm thinking that we have to pay attention to you and to Greta and to all of those that are striking that spark, but we also have to be ready to be ignited. And I know you know that. So I'm saying things that everybody knows, but it's just a reminder that if we can reach out to those who are around us and ask them if they're ready to be ignited and draw them into the flame, that will make a huge difference. So the other thing I want to ask you is a two-part question. Are you a member of WILP? And part two is, if you are not, will you accept a gift membership from me?
I would love that. Thank you. I'm ashamed to say that my membership expired and I haven't renewed it because I've been living on very low income. So I would love a gift membership from you. Thank you so much for
that's
that.
That's great. You will have it. I will call Chris Wilbeck in the morning and we'll make it happen. Thank you very much. I am so glad you're part of our community and our family.
Well, thank you. That's really sweet. And I do want to say, too, that that the issues that WELP works on, I don't know whether you all give yourself as much credit as you deserve for the range of issues that you work on, because one of the things that I've been focusing on recently is the carbon impact of the military. You know, the U.S. military is the biggest carbon emitter in the world. The single source of carbon emissions in the world. And that's where the idea that, oh, if all of us just change out our light bulbs and start driving electric cars, it'll all be better, falls apart. Because without the big changes to the big systems like the U.S. military and the agricultural, the agribusiness system, and the banking system, frankly, without those three critical systems changing dramatically, we're not going to get there. Bill McKibben loved to talk about, you know, how if every person in Vermont even did like he did one time, where he really tried to live on completely local food, completely local resources for a year, and he wrote about it. He said, but even if every person in Vermont did that, it still wouldn't even make a tiny dent in the global climate situation because of these large problems. You know, the U.S. military, the big agribusiness companies.
Well, and the next question we've got is from Nancy Price, who is on our Earth Democracy Committee and working on a project about the military as a major polluter. Nancy, why don't you, your mic is open. Go ahead and ask your question.
Yes. Well, hello, everybody, and hello, Gwen. I wanted to get back to the discussion of COP25 in Santiago, Chile, and the carbon footprint if people travel there. I think the solution to that, and the, probably the policy need that we must address, is to really focus on what do we, how do we target our demands that we might take to Santiago, Chile, actually target those here at home. Target them. I haven't looked up the schedule of congressional recess, but I would imagine that first week of December when COP25 takes place, they're either, they may just be coming home, I don't know. But I think that we should strategize about how to target our demands here at home on Congress, on the presidential candidates, and other ways, you know, develop a really good social media campaign, et cetera, so that we, you know, don't add to the carbon footprint, but we actually add to the focus here, because after all, Trump took us out of COP15, and COP15, of course, was voluntary, but I think COP25 is going to be the real, or COP20, was voluntary, but I think COP25 is going to be really a push for commitments, and also to lower the commitments from, you know, 2030 and 2050 down to, you know, what is now the predicted time frame we have of 10 to 12 years. So I'd like to strategize with people about what those demands could be and what our targets might be.
That sounds fantastic. Yeah, great idea. And you look at who the audience is for that strategy, and if you are thinking that, like, the current crop of politically elected folks in Washington is a good audience, I don't know. I think getting rid of them is a better idea. But the interesting thing I find about the international agreements is that if you look, just for example, at the U.S. and Canada, which a study that I was familiar with did, the U.S. actually has a lot of implementation of these agreements at the state and company level, but horrifically adverse impacts or adverse compliance at the federal level. Whereas in Canada, they have very high-profile federal compliance and support, but it hasn't percolated down into the local, state, and corporate agendas as much as it could. And that's an interesting lesson, because if you think that the only audience for the agreements are the politicians that are doing nothing in Washington, you might rethink that and think about what local companies, do you know, who could actually achieve some of those goals by changing their production processes, or like you are suggesting for the Red Cross, changing out their fleet to be carbon neutral and things like that. That's my response.
Yeah, thank you. There are
there are really good options locally that we should all be thinking about, and every so often they work. So
yeah.
We have I'm going to take the last question from our section president, Darian DeLue. Darian, go ahead. Your mic's open.
Okay. I just wanted to thank you so much for your reference to bringing music to climate events. I am a big supporter of the idea of reaching people through song. I wanted to make sure that other Wilpers on this call know that the Raging Grannies indeed already have a large number of climate change and fossil fuel related songs. Our Sacramento Raging Grannies will be singing on the sidelines on the 20th, and we have about six songs that we're going to run through. So they're out there. There's lots of them. And then I did have a question. I don't know if you're in a position to answer this, but I'll ask it because I think it is a kind of a troubling question. A friend of mine who is an engineer contends that the energy we can get from renewable sources of energy won't provide enough energy for the mining and construction of renewable energy thingies, windmills, solar panels, etc. So I wonder if you have any opinion on that.
I'm sorry, I didn't quite understand the question. Could you ask it again? He says that we don't have enough energy to produce windmills and solar panels, or is he saying that with wind and solar and hydro and geothermal, we can't replace all the forms of energy we use right now?
I think
sorry.
That with those kinds of renewables you just mentioned, we would not even be able to produce enough energy to make more renewable infrastructure to maintain a healthy renewable infrastructure. I think she doesn't expect us to meet current usage, but anything close to current usage.
Oh, that's an interesting thought. We're so far from it now that it seems a defeatist sort of thought rather than construct. Because, of course, you know, nobody's going to wave their magic wand tomorrow and make all of the fossil fuel consumption stop immediately. So we do need to think about a transition period and perhaps, maintaining some level of critical fossil fuel use, and that would not be the military and agribusiness, but it would be for manufacturing processes that can't use anything else, I would think, for the transition period. There are a lot of criticisms along those lines about where we are with renewables, and it's sort of true. There aren't yet commercial airliners that can fly using solar panels as their only source of energy. There's certainly not war machines that can run on renewables. So there is a bit of a challenge around that is both on the production and the consumption side. There's no question about that. But the first thing we got to do right away is get rid of all the things that we don't really need that we can certainly live without that use fossil fuels and go from there.
Hear, hear. I do suspect that mining is the big challenge because from what I've read about mining processes, they're only becoming more and more energy demanding as materials are less readily accessed.
Yeah, and a lot of these technologies, like our cell phones and the windmills, and they require rare earth metals, which are rarer and rarer all the time. I learned the other day that the reason they're called rare earths are because there is some feeling that they're not from this planet, that they might be the result of asteroid strikes and things. But I haven't researched that. It was just a comment somebody made at a talk the other day. I thought, oh, that's interesting. So there's a lot of challenges ahead, and we haven't even the depressing part is that for all the work all of us have done and that have been done all over the world, we haven't even slowed the rate of increase in carbon emissions into the atmosphere. We haven't slowed the rate of increase. It's going up exponentially. We're on the steep part of the curve. That's why things are getting crazy, and they're frankly just going to keep getting crazier because the carbon has a half-life of about 40 years, and so we're experiencing the impacts now of carbon that was emitted 30, 40 years ago. All the stuff that we've emitted since then is going to continue to cause chaos.
Just as a snippet of hopefulness, in California, electricity consumption has remained steady or gone down for the last 20 years or so, and we are working to reduce all of our energy consumption to, I think, 1995 or 2000 levels by 2030. So parts of this country, parts that are highly populated and have a lot of cars, which are one of the more challenging parts of the energy picture, are making progress.
Yay.
So thank you for your work.
I'm afraid we're over time, so I can't really take any more questions. I apologize to those people who still have their hands up. If Gwen wants to stick around for our soapbox at the end of the call, that's a ways from now, but you're welcome to do so, and maybe we can get her to answer more questions then.
And I'm also perfectly happy to answer emails if people have questions. My email address is pretty easy. It's Gwen, GWENHS, like Hall Smith, S is in Sam, H is in Hall, GwenHS@gmail.com. So if you have questions and would like to make more comments, feel free to send me an email. I'd be happy to answer.
Thank you very
much. Thank you so much, Gwen. What a great discussion.